Hello and welcome to the Writer's Block. Yes, people, it's a Writer's Block. It's a Sunday for you, but it's a Friday for us because due to countercurrent super science, we have mastered the art of time travel. And with me here tonight, I have Spencer J. Quinn and Daily Zoomer, both making their debuts on the Writer's Block. And we're going to be discussing Spencer Quinn's new novel, the world's first ever white nationalist young adult novel. Spencer, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for appearing. Thanks for giving me the chance to review this wonderful text. And since it's a young adult novel, we got an actual honest-to-God young adult here reviewing it, my good friend Daily Zoomer. Zoomer, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing well. How are you? Happy to be here. Enjoyed the book. Looking forward to talking about it.
Excellent. And since both of you are first-time guests, I'm going to give you the chance to introduce yourselves to our audience. But before we do that, we do have some crass financial concerns to address. And, of course, the Countercurrents fundraiser is, it's over. We gathered some money. Did not reach our fundraising goal, but we gathered enough to keep on trucking for at least a year. But this does not mean we're going to turn down money. So as always, and our heroic moderators from the future will be posting the Entropy link in chat, and you can always donate to Entropy and thus help us keep the lights on here and Countercurrents for a couple of weeks more, if that's possible. And of course, there's always Cash App. Now, since you cannot ask us questions because Countercurrent Super Science has not yet figured out two-way time travel, we can only travel from Friday to Sunday, not just from Sunday to Friday. Well, we can travel from Sunday to the other Friday, but where's the fun in that? You can just donate tonight. No questions asked, no questions answered, which is unfortunate, but it is what it is, I guess. And of course, we welcome donations also on DLive and Odyssey. On DLive, you can give us all of the wonderful tokens, your diamonds, your lemons, your ninja guineas, your ninjets, even the elusive ice cream. And over on Odyssey, we accept both cash money, actual American dollars, or library coin. Now, library coin, Odyssey's very own cryptocurrency. They allow us to keep the replays of these shows and other audio video material up on the Countercurrents channel. So, consider donating. And of course, those are just the direct ways. I almost forgot. Cash App. You can donate money through Cash App as well. And if our admins would just be kind enough to post that in the chat, I would be eternally grateful. Now, of course, those are all the direct ways to donate. Now, the indirect way, the best indirect way to donate is to purchase the fine products of our friends and sponsors over at Alaska Chaga. That's just divine. That's just wonderful. Beautiful, nice fungal tea. They scrape it off of the beech trees up in Alaska. And it's got antioxidants. What can I say? My entire family enjoys it. I love it. Personally, and of course, he also makes soaps, powdered chaga, and other products which help you stay healthy and clean. Just look at how handsome I am. Look at how ruddy and just in rude health my face is. This is all thanks to Alaska Chaga soap and actually, sub-zero temperatures outside. But that's a story for another day. And I do believe that's all of the crass financial concerns we have. So let's start with Spencer. Spencer, this is your first time ever on the Writer's Block. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? Assume that the person listening has never heard of you, has no idea who you are.
Okay. I started writing for Countercurrents back in 2016 and been, trying to produce as much as I can. Countercurrents published my first book, White Like You, in 2018. I had another novel published called Charity's Blade with Logik in 2020, a collection of essays on Alexander Solzhenitsyn in 2021 called Solzhenitsyn on the Right with Antelope Hill In 2020, I also published a very short, little kid book called My Mirror Tells a Story with the White People Press. And now, 2023, White People Press has also published my first young adult novel called The No College Club. And you can find me, Twitter, Gab, Facebook. And, if you go on Countercurrents, there's a good chance, you scroll down, you'll see an article that I've written.
That's amazing. And also making a first time appearance on the Writer's Block is a Daily Zoomer. Now, I've been on Daily Zoomer's show, but he has not been yet on mine. So I'm not sure if my audience is fully aware of what he's up to and what he is about. So why don't you introduce yourself to the crowd, DZ?
Yeah, so I'm the Daily Zoomer, and it's in the name. Yes, I also am a Zoomer. I run a YouTube and a BitChute channel. That BitChute channel is becoming more important each day for the obvious reasons of censorship. But on the channel, we discuss white identity politics, race realism, immigration, anti-Zionism, nationalism, the JQ, and we discuss politics and elections as well. And I think that quickly sums it up.
Right. So we have here the author of a young adult novel and a young adult and myself. I'm no longer a young adult, I guess. The sands of time, they only flow downwards, not upwards, despite advances in time travel. So, Spencer, you're the author. Why don't you give us a brief introduction to what your novel is about?
Okay. Well, you have four white high school students, and they are being exposed to this anti-white 1619 narrative from one of their teachers. And one of the students stands up to the teacher and gets in real big trouble for it. And then later on, they're given an assignment on slavery. And they make some pretty impressive discoveries about that they weren't expecting, about American history, about the history of white servitude in North America and during the colonial period. And so then they have this choice. Do we make the intended product, which would be, another anodyne presentation on black slavery, or do we risk getting in trouble, serious trouble, and even getting expelled by doing something on white slavery, which is effectively what indentured servitude was in many places. And so that's the core dilemma that they have to face. And, they all have to worry about, well, will I go to college? Will I have a career? What are these, what's the oppression I'm going to face if I make this decision now? And I'm sure that's a decision that many a dissident has had to, ponder over, especially when they're young, because, you got your whole future ahead of you and you really don't know what's coming. So anyway, that's the basic gist of the story. There's a whole lot more to it. I don't want to have any spoilers, but, that's basically, the hook.
It's amazing. And it's a very interesting concept, what would happen if a group of children had the courage to actually stand up to authority instead of just pretending to stand up to authority. I found it refreshing. I found the concept, refreshing, right? This is actually novel behavior, right? Which you see from, it's inspiring. I wish that more white children would behave like the characters in the book. But Daily Zoomer, I know you're not just I know you're not high school age, mm-hmm. but you were high school age not so long ago. So mm-hmm. How would you relate to the premise of the novel? How did you find it?
I really, really enjoyed it. And furthermore, I do think it's a book that not just young adults could enjoy. I mean, from the very beginning, the main character, Caroline, makes this kind of idea that even like 20 years ago, which I guess I would assume would be like the 2000s, mid 2000s, how like both her grandparents were alive, and the town seemed like a lot more homely and a whatnot. So like that was like a minor detail put in the book, but I think that's like a really interesting point, because even 20 years ago, you would have had, people that were born in 1950, let's say in their 50s, and now it's 20 years later, and a lot of those people have perished and whatnot here in the States. So, you know, young people today, they really don't know how to react to this. They really don't have a memory like a lot of older people do, to what like America was like when it was much more white and orderly in this kind of regard. So I think this book was just really, really relatable in a whole lot of ways for me. And I think it's becoming more relatable for many young people each day.
Indeed. Personally, I found it like I did not have the American high school experience, but I do know what it is to be in this stifling environment where you're expected to repeat lies in order to get ahead. And that's something relatable, right? That's something relatable, not just to young people, but I would say also to older people, you know, people who may have at some point been forced to repeat lies just to get ahead, just to survive in a very cruel world. And as we see, like we said, no spoilers, but it's actions are not consequence free, and courage has a cost in today's America, as well as in the No College Club. Now, I don't care how good your story is, a story lives or dies by its characters. It's something I've noticed that I cannot enjoy a story, whether it's a novel, whether it's a film, a play, or whatever it is, just our tall tale told by a friend in the beer hall, unless it's got good, vivid, and believable characters. And I think, like, this is my personal opinion as, you know, a fellow author, someone who's enjoyed fiction my entire life. I'm a big reader of fiction, right? Nonfiction, not so much. I think the characters are the strongest points of this book, right? I think the characters are the strongest aspect of this
Thank
novel.
You.
No, I'm not kidding, right? Caroline is believable. I can believe that there is a girl such as that who pretends to be a little shallow in the beginning just to fit in. And then there's, I love Rose. She's like the unpopular girl, the nerdy girl. But this gives her a sort of a strength, you know, because she doesn't care about others' opinions. It gives her a strength which Caroline learns from. Then there are the boys. You got Brock, who's an athlete, who's like a classic, he plays football. He's very strong. And then you got Derek, and he's like the metalhead, right? But he's also athletic. He's a wrestler. He's a little more offbeat, you know, not the classic jock, but still a strong man, a man of honor. And indeed, what gets the plot going? It's Derek who finds the courage to stand up to the black teacher, right, who's hectoring these poor students, treating them, you know, keeping them hostage and just pumping them full of anti-white propaganda. I really like that detail. I've heard it commented in the past that basically heavy metal is the official music of white people in the late 20th and early 21st century. And indeed, this show would not have transpired if not for heavy metal, because were not Full Moon Ancestry such a massive heavy metal fan, he would have never come to Europe. He would have never met me. We would have never started the writer's block. He would have never even gotten, I think, into white nationalism if not for heavy metal. And of course, Derek, the character in the book who really gets everything going, he's a metalhead. And I like that. I like that tiny little detail. And of course, he doesn't show it in his clothing, but Brock, the jock, he actually understands heavy metal as well. Were you inspired by any people you knew? Because that's how you know. I can usually tell when I'm reading a book and when a character is so vividly and well written, right, that this is probably based on a real person, because I can recognize the archetypes from my own life. I know a lot of guys like Derek. And I also know some guys like Brock. I know some girls like Caroline and Rose. And I even know, even though, you know, there are precious few black people in Macedonia, well, not precious, there are few black people in Macedonia, I do know a Dr. Nogimbe.
Really? I mean, I pulled that name out of a hat. I didn't, I just invented that name. It was originally, it was Dr. Ogimbe. And I pulled that out of a hat. But then I thought, no, I need to make her a little more nefarious. I need to, because I really liked how Dickens would create very vivid names, even if they stretch believability. Like there was a teacher in Hard Times named McChokum Child. Mr. McChokum Child, that was his name. That's probably Dickens's least subtle moment, but I really love it. And there's also a very wispy boy character in, I think it's Our Mutual Friend. His name is Blight. His last name is Blight, and that's how the author refers to him. So I like the idea of having descriptive names, and I thought Ogimbe sounds like, okay, she's African, and she's, you know, had this identity thing going, but I wanted something that you can hang a hook on where it's, there's this sort of nefarious bit to it. Then I thought, well, Dr. Nogimbe, like Dr. No in James Bond. And I'm like, oh yeah, that's what I'm going to go with, because she's all about no. So, but to answer your questions though, yeah, I did base these characters on people I know or have known. And oftentimes they're composites. And there's a little bit of me in them as well. So, for example, Brock is your, you know, you look at him at first and he's your typical jock. You know, he's this big guy. He's popular and such. But he's also a geek himself, because he's really turned on by medical stuff. And he has this obsession with his health. And he's actually quite literate about it. And it's funny because, you know, he will always talk about his, you know, his acid reflux when nobody else wants to hear about it. So he's sort of tone deaf that way. He doesn't quite catch social cues, like that scene where he was angering Derek and Derek was giving him hints to shut up and he didn't do it. He kept talking and he just didn't realize that he was angering Derek. And you don't want to anger Derek, because with Derek, it's real. And so then they had their big blow up because Brock just can't read social cues very well. He has to learn it the hard way. That's why he talks about game. And so this is like the composite of a couple folks I know. Same thing with pretty much all the characters.
That's amazing. And I mean, I just love that aspect of Brock where he's a little incontinent with his medical knowledge. And as someone, I really wanted to be a doctor at one point in my high school education. I can be sometimes like that with the medical stuff. But right. Daily Zoomer, I want to ask, did you recognize any of these archetypes, any of these characters from your life? Do you know any people who are like that?
Well, there certainly are teachers in which I've had that do the whole white privilege stick, that want white students to stand in a certain part of the room. I had a professor not that long ago that was a history professor that, and this is hinted at the end of the book, where like Caroline kind of makes the connection that this black history teacher isn't really, you know, doesn't really know history too well. She's more like an activist. And I had a history professor once that called James Madison incorrectly a Federalist, which he was never a Federalist. But for most of the time, he would just kind of drone on and on about white people and this and that, and whites are like inherently evil. So it is once again, like really, really relatable. And it does hit the nail on the head with race, I would say.
Yeah. I got to admit that basically the way in which Joanne, Caroline's mother, is portrayed and her absolute terror of talking about race is eerily reminiscent of some of the behaviors from older people I've seen, you know, in my own life, both online and on the internet. And you were mentioning, Spencer, about Dickens naming a character Choke a Child, whatever. I don't know if it's intentional, but I like that the principal is named Mitwitter, right? And I'm thinking, is he trying to say that the principal is a midwit? Is that what you're going for?
I will leave that to the readers to decide.
Yes, let's leave it ambiguous. But I thought, yeah, okay, maybe it's a little, is it on the nose? But because he doesn't really appear, he's not a caricature.
No.
I'm thinking, yeah, I liked it. It's a nice touch. Anyways, I got to say, this is probably the strongest aspect of the story. You got believable, vivid characters who actually correspond to archetypes we know from our daily lives, we accept from literature and from films. You got the jock, right? You got Brock. You got the a little bit misfit kid, you know, metalhead. You got Derek. You got the popular girl. She's a bit of an airhead, Caroline, but she's got a good heart. And you got Rose, who's she's not really a nerdy girl, right? She's into horses and stuff, but she's unpopular and not very, very hung up about it, which is good. It's a positive way to portray a character. Of course, the adult characters too. There's something else too. I liked Uncle Zach. There was this moment I'm reading the passages where Uncle Zach is arguing back and forth and when he's rattling off the legal boilerplate, I imagine him like a good old boy or maybe a hillbilly from the Virginia mountains out there, and he's there rattling off this hillbilly this legal boilerplate about the safety and whatever you discover, it's property of Zach Brand Associates or whatever his company is called. I found myself reading it out loud in my most outrageous hillbilly accent just because I found it so... I'm thinking, yeah, this would actually make a phenomenal scene in a movie. People would start falling out of their seats in the theater if we made this into a movie. Young lady, I'll have you know, anything you discover is, as per the legally binding contract you signed, property of Zachary Brand Associates, LTD. And that's a
you
fact.
You do that so, well. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I mean,
that was good.
I love these. I love the hillbillies, right? I love this subculture of America. I love this American culture. We did a whole show with Jim Goat on Hillbilly Elegy.
Right.
I mean, yeah.
Well, that I mean, really... the Zach is hyper literate. He's also, I mean, he's an author. He does reenactings for the Civil War, and he claims anyway that he's appeared on documentaries, and you know, he's. Yeah, you know, you're not supposed to. He's supposed to be a little sketchy. You know, it's not like he's a hero or anything. There are certain things about him where you think, all right, well, really, you know, this guy's a little bit strange, and who knows if we should trust him. At one point, Caroline's a little dubious, you know, about him. And in the end, he does. He potentially could cause a big problem for them. I don't want to get into that. That would be a spoiler. But that I had one reader. Say that this is exactly how one of his relations, one of his crazy uncles, how they would behave. So, you know, I mean, I didn't want to make him like a paladin or sterling character, but at the same time, you know that he sticks to his guns. He knows right from wrong, and he ain't pretty. And, you know, he takes a really bad stab at self-promotion with that business card that you see. You know, and that reminded me of a business card of a person I knew years ago, which was just really bad. So, you know, I mean, there should be some contradictions in there. And for the very literate out there, there's a Solzhenitsyn connection too, because Solzhenitsyn has a character named, I think it's called Zakhar the Pouch. And it's very similar. I mean, I didn't slavishly, you know, rip him off, but it's a similar sort of thing where he's a caretaker of a battlefield, and these young people show up at the battlefield, and I think it might have been Borodino or something, where it's, I think it was where the Russians defeated Napoleon or something like that years ago, and many, many people died. It was horribly bloody, and so these biking kids, they show up on their bikes and they meet this lunatic who's in charge of the place. And he's got this big pouch, and you know, that's where he keeps his booze and, you know, and who knows what else. So I was inspired very much by that. That's why I named him Zach.
Well, defeated is a strong word, but let's just say Napoleon didn't win at Borodino.
Okay.
I mean, it is really interesting. Like, you can see that he's a man of letters, but he is also a very proud Southerner, right? He dresses like maybe a slack-jawed yokel a little bit. When I read him, he has the accent, he has the phlegmatism, right, of hillbilly, of hill folk.
Well, he's willing to not take sides over the Civil War, though, remember? I mean, he was blaming both sides. He said both sides were just as guilty, and then Rose said, well, they're just as innocent as well. You know, I mean, so he's not wanting the South to rise again. He's more of he thinks of himself as a white person rather than a Southern white. So, but he sees both sides of the issue, I think.
That's a good position. I've heard it actually, believe it or not, from Jarrett Taylor, a similar position, right, where he says that essentially his ancestors, the Southerners, they were in the wrong by believing that through these methodologies we can civilize and integrate blacks, and that for all their faults, the North, for all the crimes committed in the war between the states by the Northern troops, they actually had the better of idea of let's deport these people back to Africa, the more realistic one. And in many ways, right, they're being hung up on the Southern cause may be a problem, right? May cause a problem for white solidarity down the line, or maybe it already does in certain ways. Daily Zoomer, did you enjoy those few passages of the book where the kids go to the plantation house and meet Uncle Zach?
Yeah, I got a big kick out of it. Now, I'm, of course, not from the South, so maybe that part is a little bit harder for me to relate to for the most part. But I did enjoy that part a lot. And there was kind of, you know, this is more talking about the book and the story. There was, you know, you are kind of wondering what's going to happen when Caroline is crawling up in the attic and whatnot. And there's kind of some real suspension there in the story that's going on. Back to your other question, one of the characters which you did, in which we didn't bring up, was Abe Zinger, who also to me would also be a pretty relatable character as well. And that, I do have a question about that, hopefully, that we can get to later. But
I'm all ears. Go ahead.
So this book, it seems a lot more closer to like American Renaissance and V Day. I was thinking that for a while, and I wrote my questions kind of as I was reading the book. But you do hint at this at the end, where we see that Abe Zinger is actually Jewish himself. And but throughout the book, and I kind of want your sense on this, and I think you made the right decision in order to have like a wider range of like audience, to not really talk too much about Jewish influence. In fact, when one more thing. When there's that kind of argument in the car between Derek and Brock, Brock is saying, "Look at the white people and the opiates," and then Derek says, "Well, they're getting screwed over because the media would and institutions would rather talk about Mexicans, Muslims, and blacks." He doesn't even mention Jews there. Right. So I was just wondering, and I think you probably made the right decision not talking about that, but just to hear your two cents on that, I'd be curious.
I mean, the JQ is a tad more advanced than I would say most kids are going to be able to swallow. I mean, because, you know, you if you're a kid and you have Jewish friends, you don't know any of this stuff. And it's hard. It's very difficult to relate to if you're not an adult. Actually, one of my readers gave it to a 12-year-old to read, and the 12-year-old loved it. So I would feel kind of strange, you know, going over the JQ with a 12-year-old. It just doesn't seem right to me. And so the very idea of it, off the page, they become pretty based on the JQ between the historical chapters. I mean, but from the end of the was it chapter 16 or 17, where the last modern day chapter, then you have the historical chapters, then you come back to the modern day. Within that time, they get pretty based on the JQ because of the historical stuff. And it's very subtle. It's not, I mean, a kid cannot even, it can go right over their heads and they won't, they can still enjoy the book. But grownups will know. And the only thing is that in the end, the term anti-Semitism gets brought up once, I think. And so a child may ask, you know, hey dad, what's anti-Semitism? You know, because then they won't know, they won't be able to put everything together until they learn what that is. And then they'll have to go back and say, whoa, there are details in this book I missed. Let me go back and reread it, which is always what you want as an author. You know, you don't want somebody to just do one and done and never open it again. You want the thing to live and breathe. So, you know, with a name like Abe Zinger, pretty much anybody that's fluent with the JQ is going to know ding, ding, ding. Yeah, that, you know, and I liked how it began his, it's A to Z, you know, it's sort of, he encompasses the whole thing. Right. And if you look at the way I describe him and how he admires Trotsky, and how he very, very obnoxiously claims to be white. And I mean, that's a meme or a trope now that everybody talks about how a Jewish person on Twitter will claim to be white when it suits them. And then they'll claim to be Jewish when it suits them. Right. So that's what Abe does. And Caroline and Rose instinctively hate that. They know he's not telling the truth. They know he's not a nice person, but he's virtue signaling in such an obnoxious way. And there's nothing they can do about it. And they don't really put two and two together about Abe himself. But it's only after what they learn about the past, which is also very subtle, that they began off screen or off the page, they say, oh, okay, I get it now. You know, Aaron DaCosta, okay, he's not so innocent either, right? So who are you to be, you know, claiming to be not innocent? I mean, claiming to be innocent when you're not. Who are you to be ascribing historical sins to us when you have plenty of your own? You know, and that's basically what Derek and Brock give to him.
Yeah, the boys are quicker on the uptake, and I do believe there is that moment in the car where Derek says to Brock that Abe is not white, right? He's not one of us. Derek,
it's
is
not
already,
in the car. That's at the very car? End. No, they're not talking about Abe in the car. Abe, they talk about the Abe actually tries to pile on against them when they're giving their presentation. Mm-hmm. And Derek just sees right through it. And because Abe is saying, well, as a white person, blah, blah, blah. And he says, shut up. You're not white. You don't consider yourself white. I see through your stuff. And, you know, and then he makes hints about the sordid history of Jews. And Abe says, well, that's anti-Semitic. And he says, well, yeah. And what you've been saying isn't anti-white. Excuse me. You know, and it's that's basically the end of the four kids being free people. That is the last, that is their last moment as free individuals. After that, everything else is decided for them for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I enjoyed, well, I didn't enjoy Abe Zinger as a character. That's the point, really. He's supposed to be this annoying twerp. Even, I mean, you understand, like, because we're all in the know about the Jewish question, you understand immediately what this guy is supposed to represent. But I would say even to someone who's not aware of this question, you know, it immediately, but there are people like this, and there are Gentiles like this, right? It's not just Jews who behave like Abe, who are false people. They wear false faces. They pretend to be your friend, but they're really just superficial. They're just trying to get ahead at any cost, and they don't really have a genuine intelligence, right?
Correct.
I love his name, that his name is Zinger. He's really good at coming up with zingers. He's got this deaf verbal IQ, but he has no depth of understanding, really, not really, you know. He's this super, very superficial person, and that's a theme, right? In the first part of the book, before they sort of become this gang of friends who are now outcast, there's a lot of superficial concerns, even among the four heroes of the story, especially in Caroline. she's the main character, of course, and the book is sort of a Bildungsroman, sort of her emergence from this superficial existence as a popular girl and her transformation into, well, you know, it's a happy ending. It's all I'm going to say. But she transforms into something beautiful towards the end. That's, we need to discuss this. Like, there is the, there are these, this clique of popular girls, right? The clique, as they call it, and they're led by a black girl, which is very interesting to me because I grew up watching, Clueless with Alicia Silverstone. So the ultra popular girls in American high schools, would I always imagined them to be these waspy blondes who are skinny and all the guys want to be with them. But all of a sudden, the most popular girl in this representation is a black and she's overweight. Have things changed since I've been a kid, Spencer?
Possibly. The thing is that it's not like she was the most popular. It's more like she was in the process of wresting that title away from Caroline. See, the clique was hers. She was the most popular girl of the clique. And when Medina shows up, it's there's some conflict there. And so you can look at it like that. I have no idea about you know, what kind of girl is popular these days in high school. That's something I just didn't look into. I just saw her as a dominant character, and I saw Caroline as refusing to be dominated by her, and that was a sin in Medina's eyes. And so Medina, you know, had to basically do what she did, which was, you know, extremely dastardly and vicious. But, you know, kids can, well, anybody can be dastardly and vicious. And so, yeah, DZ can tell you if things have changed better than I can. But I wasn't thinking in terms of who might be popular these days or not. I just, you know, wanted to have Caroline as the centerpiece of that group. She's the beautiful one, the very good looking girl and the very popular one. And she's now being challenged by this light-skinned, slightly overweight black girl with a very dominant personality. And that, to me, is very symbolic of many things that are going on in the broader culture.
Yeah, I was going to pose this question to you, Daily Zoomer. How are the demographics of American high schools right now? And do you see this kind of intermingling of black and white students, or do they mostly keep to each other?
I still think for the most part, they generally keep to them. Like the school lunch table is like one of the kind of aspects of race realism in a way, where a lot of the groups do kind of sit with their own to a large extent. I will also say this does feel like a story that would be more in the South because there's more blacks. I grew up on the Northeast. I don't live there anymore. So I will just say it. I grew up in a suburb of New York City, not too far actually from where John Derbyshire of VDare lives. That's public information, so I don't have to feel ashamed of saying that. But the one we definitely have had a ton of demographic change, but it's almost mainly like Hispanic immigration at this point, mestizo immigration, if you will. Like there are areas of Long Island where like half the stores are in Spanish. Like Spanish is like the native language. It's full of mestizos almost all over the place. So my school, you ran in with these experiences. I actually had a friend that got jumped by like a bunch of mestizos kids not that long ago. I would say my experience with high school, yes, we do have obviously populations of blacks, but I think the mestizo kind of Hispanic, you could say, influence is much, much greater to where I grew up. It seems like in this story, it seems a lot more Southern because it seemed like there were a lot more blacks for the most part than I don't know if you have anything to add.
I think the story takes place in Virginia, right?
Believe it or not, I didn't specify where their hometown is, and I didn't give it a name on purpose because I wanted this to not necessarily represent an individual high school that you can point to, but instead to represent what's basically happening to white America. So, and the timelines aren't exactly right either, if you think about it. I mean, if this takes place, I don't know, 2015, 2018, whenever you want it to take place, if you look at the timing, the immigration was not, it wasn't like it didn't happen in 2002 and now it's happening. I mean, it was happening then too. But I wanted to create a symbol for white America. So this high school is a symbol, or the school system is a symbol for white America. So when Caroline was in third grade, it was all white, you know, and then slowly you had all these different people come in. So you have the blacks come in, you have the Hispanics, you have the Asians and Muslims as well. And now all of a sudden you have this, you know, the whites who at one point were the entire population of the school system are now a minority. And the townies, the people who are from that town, are a minority among the whites. So this is very much symbolic of what's going on today in the West. So I definitely wanted to go there. If you had to place it, it's someplace either in Pennsylvania, Kentucky, or Ohio, or Indiana. I mean, someplace that you can, where you can drive a couple hours to two and a half hours to get to Washington, D.C. or that area. So maybe Northern Virginia, it's possible, I guess. But I mean, I wanted to keep it.
What made me believe it's Northern Virginia, it's precisely that you pointed out that it's not just these non-whites moving in, but a bunch of whites who are not townies. And the non-whites that are moving in, you got the blacks, right? But it's a bunch of Asians and Middle Easterners and Indians. And one of the reasons why Virginia is now essentially a blue state, it's because a bunch of people are moving in around Washington, D.C. into Northern Virginia, and they're moving in from all over the world. A lot of them are Indian, a lot of them are Chinese, or they're from the Middle East, and a lot of them are just shitlibs from other parts of America, or, you know, libtarded Europeans moving in, becoming citizens, and now they're voting. And now Virginia is a blue state because it has a cancerous growth on top known as Washington, D.C. And so I always imagined that this is a town which at one point may have been a historic Virginian town, but it's now flooded not only with blacks, but all of these other imperial bureaucrats orbiting around D.C., which distort the demographics of the historical city.
They do cross the Appalachian Mountains to get to D.C. So if you look at the map, I mean, maybe West Virginia, but it's I see your point, and it's good that people come away with that interpretation. I mean, that's fine, but they do go over the Appalachians. So, you know, you can look at a map and figure it out from there.
Yeah. I think what Daily Zoomer is really trying to get to, that even though, you know, you could use the novel as symbolic of the plight of the white race everywhere, you know, every experience.
So, yes.
I'm sorry.
I said, I hope so. Yes.
Every experience of white people feeling demographic displacement is localized, right? It's always a little bit of a different flavor depending on where you are. And I would say, yeah, that mestizos are glaring by their absence in the novel, whereas you would say that for the majority of Americans, they will represent the primary demographic threat rather than blacks or maybe Asians and Indians.
Yeah. I think that's a good point. That's why I was assuming and like Virginia and whatnot, it could be somewhere in Virginia. I guess that would have been my guess, though some Virginians would say Virginia isn't really the South. So I guess that's it's kind of another way to sort of look at it. But a lot of Asian immigration as well, where like I am. There's obviously the character in which I got a kick out of. I believe it was Mr. Fu, or Miss Fu, or someone, the violin teacher, which
Fang
I
Fu.
Fang Fu.
Yeah.
Yes.
Sort of like Eric Swalwell's mistress, Fang Fang. So I called her Fang Fu.
Isn't that like the dragon from Iron Man, Fing Fang Foom?
Something. I'm not really sure of that. Possibly.
I don't know if Zoomer, are you old enough to remember the Iron Man Saturday morning cartoon where a Mandarin would summon Fing Fang Foom, the dragon from the mountains?
Gosh, I don't think so.
I was exposed to that. Wasn't that like young Iron Man? Wasn't he? Wasn't that a young Iron Man character? Because I remember watching this stuff in the 2000s, and I realized how based some of this programming was. This is just an aside, but I noticed how there were. It was actually quite conservative, some of the messaging. With the Iron Man, and there was another one as well. I don't remember exactly what, but I was impressed by the fact that, you know, like, for example, they would talk about the Soviet Union as being such an oppressive, horrible thing, and somebody barely got out alive, and that kind of thing. And you don't really would see that from the woke left. And I thought, okay, somebody's doing the writing for this program actually knows what's up, at least somewhat.
I mean, it's hard to have a believable Mandarin and not make a yellow peril type villain. You know, it's hard to make the Mandarin a believable villain without making him into essentially Fu Manchu, but with magical powers. And in that show, they make him a white man who somehow attained Chinese magical powers, but it still works so well as at instilling a very healthy distrust of Asians into the young white man. Speaking of that, I want to segue into, because I love this in many ways, you know, that they're ancillary characters and they form a lot of the background noise of the novel. This is good. It shows there is a whole living, breathing world outside of just the story. It helps with immersion, helps you with suspension of disbelief, doesn't break so often. But I love these bit characters you have, like these Asians and these Indians, and just how mercenary they are, especially Priya. I think that Priya, who is one of the popular girls, just her willingness to sell Caroline out is really something you see in subcontinentals and in Asians, just their lack of honor and their mercenary nature. People often get caught up in this, oh, they don't commit so many crimes, they're high IQ, they work hard. Yeah, but they're also not here for your benefit. They're strongly nepotistic, and they do not have the sense of honor you and I have. They do not want to live in our society. They have an agenda of their own. And, of course, there is the character of the violin teacher that Daily Zoomer pointed out, the Asian woman who promotes only Asians to first violin, to orchestra. I love these. These are all nice touches. We speak a lot about the JQ in this movement. We speak a lot about blacks and mestizos. I think we're ignoring, in many ways, the threat from Asians and subcontinentals, which in the long term is probably the highest from these populations, right? Because they have a comparable, maybe not our equal, but they do have a comparable civilizational capacity to white people. And that worries me. It worries me that we're willing to consider them as possible friends when they're in fact deeply hostile to us.
Yeah. To kind of point on this with like sort of personal experience, like if you look at New York City, that is quite diverse, obviously. You have like enclaves of Chinatown, which is obviously all the Chinese, and they're very loyal to themselves. They're very cliquey in that regard, I guess you can say. Even in Queens, you have like enclaves of Asians, and obviously in the rich parts of you know, maybe suburbs on the Northeast, you're getting more and more Asians in there, and they're taking, yeah, and engineering jobs, high paying jobs. So yeah, and it does seem like for some reason it's probably because it's just not as glaring as like you know, Mexican illegal immigrant crime, black crime. So it's probably why we don't focus on it as much. But they are very tribal and very loyal to them, to themselves. Even here in America, that is definitely carried over, and you see it in even very diverse cities like a New York City. Actually, I was in Boston not that long ago with a buddy of mine who and we were looking at the campuses like WPI and other sort of campuses around Boston and whatnot. And you know, there were like Asians only hanging out with Asians on these campuses, and that's gonna translate to the real world for sure. So
right,
absolutely.
I had that.
Second that.
I totally had that in mind. Like for example, you know, when Caroline was talking to her friend, and the friend was trying to get her back into the clique, all she has to do is apologize to Medina, you know, and she said that Priya agrees, and Caroline's like, well, she always agrees. She always agrees with us. I mean, you know, when does she not, right? And so there is a sense of self-attainment, and yeah, I mean, it's harsh, but lack of honor is part of that as well. I wanted to make it subtle and much softer than what you get from the black characters or from Abe. But yeah, I wanted to make it there. I definitely wanted to make it present so that students who or young people who read this will say, yeah, you know, I detect this undercurrent as well. It might not be as over the top as grownups would see or as college students would see. It might be less so in high school. I definitely wanted to touch upon that so that students and young people are aware that tribalism, you know, it goes deep, and young people practice it as much as old people do.
Indeed. And I'm glad the characters are there. DZ, you wanted to say something.
Yeah. I would just add one more point to that, not to dive too much into politics, but obviously the Republican Party, when they talk about affirmative action, they often talk about, well, it's these Asians getting screwed from the affirmative action. They don't want to talk about white people necessarily. So not only do you have like high IQ people coming in, dominating the universities, they want to maybe give them affirmative action in some cases, saying that it's like racist. We should only discriminate against white people in the universities and whatnot. So I guess I would just throw that in there as well.
You're correct.
I think there is a hope among the Republican Party that, oh, well, since this minority is not criminal and maybe higher IQ, they can be on our side. And they do have a limited success. The example I'm going to bring up is not Republican. It's conservative from the United Kingdom. But I would say that the Rishi Sunak, he's a point of pride among British conservatives. Like, okay, the first non-white prime minister of the United Kingdom, well, that's actually Benjamin Disraeli.
Second, yeah.
Yeah, they don't see it that way, right? The first Indian prime minister of the United Kingdom, the first subcontinental, is a conservative. What a great achievement for traditional values or something, right? And he's not even particularly conservative. He's one of these Davos Forum type people, these international capitalist people. He's got a lot of fingers in a lot of pies. He's got some familial connections to the Russian state, to a bunch of Russian oligarchs, but he's also good in with the West, playing both teams, playing both sides, as these people usually do. And we're going to see a lot of these, okay, based browns in the subcontinental sense, or, you know, based yellows from China or wherever, as America and the United Kingdom and other white countries become less white, expect to see the right and conservatism to be redefined into something non-white. I mean, we're already seeing this online, people saying, oh, castizos are the future of the American right, castizo futurism or whatever. Or you see European political parties appealing to Muslim conservatism, because well, don't you know, the Conservative Party dislikes all of these other things you dislike as pious Muslims. Well, what's the point, really, unless white people's interests are protected? What good are conservative parties? And it's not, people will always say, immigration is going to destroy the conservative parties. Not necessarily. Mexico has conservative parties. Non-white countries also have conservative parties. Conservatism is not necessarily a white thing and will not remain a white thing for long because, well, conservatives like winning, politically speaking. And that's something we got to contend with.
Yeah. I mean, with the Eastern Indian sort of question, I guess you could say already, just name off the top of your head, Raheem Kassam, Dinesh D'Souza, Sagar and Jannetty. And yeah, I think that makes sense. I mean, they're going to have wealth, obviously, you know, they're high IQ, but they're in these universities. It would make sense that eventually they could end up going to the party that wants to cut their taxes. It just kind of makes sense, I guess, to add the obvious.
Yeah. We talk about, you know, there's a bunch of rich Indians and rich Chinese, and they're just pouring money all over the Western political spectrum. And nobody really talks about it because nobody questions the rights of these obvious foreigners to interfere in Western politics. But it happens. Now, I want to move on to Spencer mentioned the friend who tries to get Caroline to bargain with the system. That's Jennifer, right? Jennifer is a white girl. She's not a townie, right? She's one of these white people who came in after, but she's the one who chooses to side with the blacks and with Dr. Nogimbe and with Medina and the system against Caroline and her newfound friends. Even though Jennifer and Caroline were, you know, the best of friends, and Caroline went on vacation with her family and whatnot. And she represents a very important archetype, one that sadly is quite common, and that is of the white traitor, right? The white, let's call it a liberal, sometimes a conservative, the white person who will do anything, sell out all of his friends and principles just to avoid being called racist. His greatest fear is being perceived of as a racist, and he considers racism to be the greatest possible evil a white person can commit. And I really like the addition. Like I said, this any narrative lives or dies by its characters, and the characters in this novel are very strong. They're very vivid. They're very real. There are a lot of Jennifers out there. There are a lot of people out there who will say, oh, no, you should apologize to this black person for having been racist to them by speaking the truth or refusing to lie or whatever. It's, I want to ask you, Spencer, is this based on a real person or is this just based on the general tendency you see in these people? To our people, sadly, to betray our racial solidarity.
Hard to say. I had a oftentimes when I compose characters, I will find a physical type that of someone I knew or someone I know that I remember, and then I might graft onto that character a different personality of somebody else that I knew. That's how it was with Brock. With Jennifer, she's I did less of that simply because it wasn't as necessary. She's not the kind of character that actually did anything that would push the plot forward. So I didn't need to have her make her as absolutely vivid as the others because she also gets less time. But I do know that the fear that she has, the willingness to sell out or the willingness to say one thing and do another just to have a comfy life. Yeah, I'm very familiar with that. And I know plenty of people who have take that perspective. And the way you pointed out, like being a traitor, it would be, it's almost like that, but not quite, because it doesn't matter to her if it's racist or not, just as long as she's not being called a racist. You know, she doesn't care about the truth behind it very much. She cares about her popularity. She cares about what's good for her directly, you know, and that comes to the fore very quickly when she has to choose between Medina and Caroline, right? It doesn't really matter. I mean, if Caroline were the one that had all the institutionalized support, she would support Caroline over Medina. So it wouldn't really matter to her. She flows with the breeze. And so I knew quite a few people like that who, you know, really were not substantive. And the thing is that she does try. I mean, she really does try to bring Caroline back, because she probably really does like Caroline and she does miss her. And she, at the end of the story, at the end of the novel, she's not in a good place. She's not happy. You know, and she may realize this and hate herself for it. She might be honest enough with herself to know this, but you judge a person more by their actions than by what they should have, could have done, you know, or what they feel guilty about. That's not so important. But I did try to bring in some three dimensions there. She's just not strong enough to resist Medina and everything that's backing her and everything that is that she stands for. She's just not strong enough to do it, even though she kind of wishes she were, and even though, you know, she misses her dear friend Caroline, whom she really, you know, really does like a lot. So I try to thread that needle, and, you know, with a character that's a minor character, I don't think I needed to, you know, bang that drum too much. I think I did it just enough. I hope so anyway.
What's it? I mean, I'm going to disagree with you about her being, having a minor role. The way I read the book, right, is it's when Caroline is, and Caroline explicitly compares Jennifer's attempts to bring her, you know, back into the fold as Satan tempting Jesus in the desert. I thought that was a wonderful touch. It's precisely then that Caroline understands what I'm dealing with is satanic. It's evil. She's asking me to repudiate the truth, to betray the truth. And I think that is the precise moment where Caroline becomes radicalized. Radicalized not in the sense that she becomes extreme, but she chooses to embrace the search for the root of the matter. She embraces to sacrifice for the truth no matter what, when she is being tempted in this Luciferian manner by Jennifer. You know, come back to the popular girl clique. All you have to do is renounce the truth.
Right, exactly. But the thing is, though, is that she is the foil for Caroline, but it's not something that she does on her own. It's not like Jennifer says, okay, I'm going to make a decision, and here I'm going with this decision or this choice, and that's going to set the plot forward. It's not it. She's important only in relation to Caroline. You see, and you're right. I mean, she is the agent of Satan, or that she tempts her to come back, and it is quite tempting, and Caroline is tempted. So you make an excellent point about that. But I never saw her as a character that would act in such a way that would propel the plot, because even if she hadn't done that, Caroline, there's a good chance she probably would have, with the influence of Derek and the others, she probably would have been radicalized. Maybe not at that moment. It might not have been as crystallized and as fun to read, you know, because I wanted to have that where she was actually being tempted and to her to resist that temptation. So, yeah, but I see your point. I think that's valid.
I mean, it works out so well. And I'm always reminded when people say, oh, realistically, it would happen like that. Hitchcock had this great sentence, this great quote, like, drama is life with the dull bits cut out, right? What you don't see is, like, from my own red pilling process, that it was just an extended process of reading and assimilating progressively more pro-white literature over a period of 3 to 4 years, right? That does not make a good novel or a good film. So,
exactly.
We live or die by narrative. That's something we gotta understand. Stories are more powerful than the truth. They are life with the dull bits cut out.
But I also hope one day that, excuse me, I'm sorry. I also hope one day that a reader, a young reader, would read this, and then this moment will be in their minds. And so when they encounter something like that in real life, they're going to say, wait a minute, I've been here before. Oh, that's right. Caroline experienced this very thing. And that will help crystallize, you know, their transformations and their growth in real life. I mean, that's what I'm hoping for anyway.
Right, right. I really liked it. And I like this addition of the detail that Jennifer is not a townie, so she's not a rooted person. And like I said, in my reading, in my understanding, this happens somewhere near DC. And it's, so it's full of these mercenary people brought in from all over the world to work in the imperial capital. That's just my understanding of it, though, of course. Different people may have a different reading of it. I'm a little obsessed with the empire and its capital. Seeing as how my own life has been defined by interaction with it. But I think the Daily Zoomer has something to say.
Yeah, I have something to add on the thing where you guys talk about white traitors, let's say. And I wouldn't say that Brock, Caroline, Rose were white traitors per se. But when you first see this, I mean, you see this several times throughout the book, but the first time I really saw it, and this kind of gets to the title of the book, I think, to a large degree, where Caroline kind of says to Derek when they're kind of fighting, when they're having this argument on the bus, she's like, Derek, don't you want to go to college? And he kind of just shrugs and is like, I don't know. At least that's kind of like the vibe I got from it. I don't necessarily want to go to college. So I wouldn't say that they're white traitors, but you see Brock saying like, well, I don't want to do this project because I don't want to lose my football scholarship or something like this. So it's not exactly, I wouldn't define them being a white traitor, but even in some of the main characters, we see not exactly being a white traitor, but more so, I'm going to accept a certain place at some point because I'm going to go to college and I want to get a college degree and I want to do this and I want to do that. I have a follow-up question to that, but I guess I'll just ask now. What do you, because Mr. Quinn, you wrote this book, obviously, so... The kind of idea of the no college club, and once again, I'd refer to the part in the book where like Derek kind of shrugs at Caroline, like, I don't want to go to college. Do you think younger people, realistically, do you think they should sort of keep their mouth shut in certain situations and get, I guess, something that can allow them to maybe get into a position of power, or is that all just BS or something? I'm curious, like if there's anything you have to say on that.
Well, different strokes for different folks. And so if you're a young white kid and you're very good at math and you're very good at it, you want to be an engineer or you want to, you know, go into a technical field. Yeah. You know, you really should go to college and get your degree and keep your mouth shut and not make waves and stuff. And so you can pull in those 6-7 figures, whatever. If you are more of an activist bent, or if you are just passionate about the truth, then there should be an option about not going to college. There should be an option that you can say, well, like Timothy Leary in the 60s, where he would say, tune in and drop out, right? I believe Jim Goad mentioned that to you, Nick, in your last stream with him. And this is similar to that, where, and Caroline explicitly says this at the very end. It's not that, you know, we're against college. It's just that you need to have realistic attitude that yes, you don't necessarily need to do this. You can survive without it. You can make a life for yourself. You don't have to feel that you're being blackmailed by the system where, you know, you have to behave or you'll be a nothing. It's sort of like what the Soviets used to do with the Communist Party. You know, it's like, if you didn't join the Communist Party, then you could still live and breathe, but you know, you wouldn't have much chance of advancement, you know, that kind of thing. And you know, the best dissidents were saying, well, I'm not joining the party. I'm going to do my own thing. And that it's because of the dissidents that we have, I believe, you know, a lot of the counterculture that led to the fall of the Soviet Union, although I know it was a lot more complex than just that. So I would say that know thyself to any young person thinking about this, know thyself. If you really feel that you're extremely bright and you have, you know, bright in a technical way, then you probably should just game the system as much as you can to get that law degree, to get that engineering degree or medical degree or whatever, and then start making a lot of money and serving the cause. Because in many ways, money is they're like, each dollar bill is like a soldier, you know, that we put off into war. I mean, you can look at it like that. But if you're not of a technical bent and, you know, you're looking at a job in sales, or you're looking at a job in, I don't know, any other kind of a people person kind of position, and, you know, you think, well, all right, is college and going to debt over college, is that really going to help me that much? You know, you can start thinking about starting your own business. You can start thinking about writing or doing activism or doing something that will push for the truth. You know, but in each case, it's for the individual to decide, I would say. I hope that answers your question, because that was a hard question to answer.
Okay. Do you have anything to say about, like, the evolution of the characters saying, like, I want to go to college. I need my scholarship. And then, like, eventually they're like, you know what, maybe I don't need it. I guess you did
right.
Kind of answer.
Well,
that.
I mean, all characters go through a character arc. They go through, you know, it would be really, really dubious of me to have all four characters, you know, coming out of Zeus's head fully formed, like what, Athena, I forget who it was, but, you know, just to start on page one, we are, you know, full-blown dissident right activists, and here we are, you know, speaking truth to power. I mean, that's not very believable. It's not fun. It's not useful. I wanted them to have a story arc where they're still seeing themselves fitting into the world. And yes, as Nick pointed out, it's not as drawn out as it would be in real life, but it is drawn out over, you know, 110, 120 pages or whatever, where the kids basically turn from innocent children who don't realize they're being duped into, you know, actors who are really trying to undermine a corrupt system. And it's not easy for them to do it. So in Brock's case, he's a football star. And he's looking at a possible career in the NFL. At the very least, he's looking at getting a scholarship to a university. And his idea is, well, wait a minute, you know, I got a ton to lose. Derek, on the other hand, has very little to lose. His father's gone, and not for a good reason either. And he's already an outlaw. In a sense, he sees himself as an outlaw from the very beginning. I mean, Nogimbe kicked him out of the class. He's in trouble with the teacher. He gets booted off with Mitwitter, with the principal. He gets booted off the wrestling team. I mean, this guy has got nothing. And so he's got nothing to lose. And very few people are going to catch this, but there's one of my all-time favorite lines in literature is from Huckleberry Finn by Mark Twain, where Huck Finn is contemplating whether or not he's going to help Jim escape the escaped slave or not, whether he's going to be a dissident against the system or not. And he says, well, I already am an outlaw in a sense. So if I'm going to be an outlaw, I might as well go whole hog. And that, I don't know what it was, but that just gives me goosebumps just remembering that line. It just means everything to me to have Huck Finn become this renegade in a sense. And he's like, well, you know, if I'm going to do it, I might as well do it all the way. And that's Derek. I mean, I rip off Mark Twain. I'm not ashamed to admit this, but if you reread that passage, I don't quote him directly, but anyone who knows the two books will definitely know that what I'm doing there. And in a sense, he's like an inverted Huck Finn, because Huck Finn was doing it on behest of a black person who was on the run. Whereas here, you know, it's like, no, it's on behest of white people or white slaves. So, you know, I wanted that. I definitely wanted that switcheroo in there so that all the lit critics can go nuts talking about it later. There's also Caroline. She's got plenty to lose because she's on the top of the pecking order in terms of popularity. She's very pretty. She gets excellent grades. She also will go to college. And so, you know, when she's starting out, all she can think about is her bright future as well. So she has a lot to lose. With her, though, she's got this crush on Derek. And so I do go into the romance novel trope a little bit, where, you know, the girls are in love with the bad boy. Well, Derek's a bad boy. I mean, he's very honorable, but he's a real man in many ways, but he's also the criminal or the outlaw, and there's something sexy about that. And so she's sort of drawn to him in a way that, you know, you would find in many romance novels. And so she has this mad crush on this guy. And at the same time, he's speaking sense. I mean, he's very informed. It's not like he's some sort of bigoted reactionary who just is inarticulate. No, he actually knows what he's talking about. So her mind and her heart are taken in by this guy. So she is led away from the fold or Plato's cave, you know, with that. Whereas Brock, it's like the promise of a football career. And with Rose, it's all family. And Rose demonstrates how if you have a strong, tight-knit family of like three or four siblings and you all love each other and you all pitch in together, you know, you could stand up to a lot. And so, you know, she works on her parents' horse farm and she's a farmer herself in her bones. She's a farmer. And so she's like, well, yeah, I could do this too because I got family to back me up. And you don't see that because, you know, it's a short book. I can't include, you know, I can't make this thing 300 pages for a young adult audience. I had to keep it brief. And so she just talks about it, but maybe in sequels, I will explore that. But this is family is definitely the source of her strength.
That's interesting with Rose, because as you put it, you know, Derek already has nothing to lose. And while Rose has things to lose, she also has a very strong safety net in the form of her parents. So really, the ones who have everything to lose are Brock and Caroline. You know? And Caroline in particular, you know, she's enthralled by Derek. She's enthralled by his strength of character, by his slaying of the dragon, so to speak, by his verbal defeat of Dr. Nogimbe. Which, you know, she's a Dr. Nogimbe. She's like a sassy black woman. That's like the top of the woke totem pole, like the most oppressed you can be without being trans or Jewish or whatever. And so in a sense, here you have this heterosexual white man who's unashamed of it, and he defeats this black dragon and charms the pretty princess. And Brock's motivations, I mean, he's not doing it for love, right? He's doing it for love of truth, because he's this quirky, sort of autistic person who can't start talking about gastric problems, right? But he also cannot stop himself from seeking out what is and screaming it to the world. I get a feeling that Derek everything always has this shit-eating grin on his face, right? It's not that it's a big joke to him, but he's having a lot of fun doing it. Whereas Brock, it's more he's going to see this through the end, right? He's a man on a mission. He's seen a thread hanging, and he's going to follow it all the way. So that's very interesting to get into the character motivations. Like I said, very strong, very vivid characters in this novel.
Thank you.
Right. I think that's interesting. Now, like we said, no spoilers, but there is a happy ending, and this ending is so happy. Actually, I wrote to a friend. I think I may have diabetes now from Spencer's book. He's also read it, so he understands. But it is a rarely positive text, right? I was thinking if I were to write a book about being a dissident, it would be quite depressing. Of course, I have a melon. No, actually, I have a phlegmatic personality, but where do you find the strength to be so positive, Spencer?
Oh, well, you should read White Like You. That doesn't have a happy ending at all. Charity's Blade has a very open ending that is actually quite controversial among the people who've read it. Some people love it, some people hate it. There's no I mean, everybody had a very strong reaction to it. But with, it's a young adult novel, and I want to have sequels. So if I ended on a downer, that kind of shoots myself in the foot a little. And because it's a young adult novel, you know, there's a certain didactic aspect to it that I don't have in my more grown-up fiction. I mean, it's, I try to make it as subtle as possible. I don't want to be preachy and stuff, but there are passages in there where information is being transmitted from basically from the author to the reader, not really from the character to another character or from the narrator to the reader. It's the author. And I don't have a lot of that, but there's some, and you know, some of it, you know, about the history of the, of indentured servitude and stuff. And there's a little bit of that. And so I don't want to turn people off on dissident ideas and have like a depressing ending when you're reading it at age 13, because then you're going to say, oh my God. You know, I mean, I remember, why would I want to go down that road? It's just all defeat, right? So for example, one of my favorite novels is Darkness at Noon by Arthur Koestler. And that's got a, I mean, that's a depressing as hell ending. I read it as a young man, like in my, maybe I was 20. And I remember it had a really powerful effect on me, but it was a grown-up effect where I was able to almost cry at the tragedy of it. But for a 14-year-old reading this, and I'm competing with all the other young adult fiction out there, you know, I didn't want to come down. I didn't want to come down very hard at all compared to how I could have, because I want this thing to live on as a series. So, you know, that's one reason. But also, I didn't want to turn people off from the idea and from the from dissidents in general, because it's a hard road to hoe. But if you have family and you have each other and you work hard and you're honest and all that, you can make it work. And there are benefits to it as well. So that there's some calculation involved. But because writing a young adult novel, even though this will appeal to adults, you're writing a novel that's suitable for young adults required a little more thinking on my part, a little more calculation on my part than my previous two novels where I was just trying to best Dostoevsky.
That's interesting. Yeah. About the didactic parts, those were, I got to admit, I found them a little on the nose. Like I found them breaking my suspension of disbelief right in the middle of Carolyn's thoughts, or, you know, a character suddenly breaking their usual pattern of speech and just delving into this historical anecdote. That was, I would say, one of the shortcomings of the book. I mean, the novel has this as a shortcoming. I found it a little, I hate that when you suddenly become aware that, yeah, actually, I'm still me and reading a book, you break your immersion in the world. What I did find amazingly done was the Percival Smythe manuscript. Now, that was a phenomenal way of actually giving historical background. I learned quite a lot. I did not know so much about indentured servitude in America before reading this. Actually, I knew from reading your own work, the work of Mr. Jim Goad, who's actually descended from indentured servants, and from the work of David Hackett Fisher, you know, Albion's Seed, although he's actually not quite as explicit as he could have been about the Virginia indentured servants. But that was actually informative, a very informative about the plight of white slaves in America. I don't know, indentured servants, not slaves. And that's what I found very interesting.
Thank you very much. Yes, those chapters were a real challenge to write, and I was very happy with how they turned out.
Yeah, it was a very, I would say, probably the most engaging part of the novel were the historical anecdotes of William Percival Smythe. This is, of course, you know, when our readers will purchase and read their novels, that everything will fall into place. Sometimes, you know, we discuss these things; they're not very clear. but to the reader, they become clear immediately. How did you feel about the historical anecdote, the Percival manuscript, Daily Zoomer?
I thought it was really, really fascinating. And to be honest, I really didn't know too much about that either. You know, I've heard about white slavery, that the Arabs kind of had enslaved whites to varying degrees, I guess. But I really didn't know too much about that. So that was also very interesting for me to read. I thought there was good information in this book in general. At the very end of the book, they talk about white oppression that went on in the Soviet Union and in the Ottoman Empire as well, which I really don't know a lot of history about the Ottoman Empire. So that was interesting to me as well. But yeah, no, I thought that was really, really interesting and something that was really cool to add.
How did you guys react to the difference in narration? Because you go from a third person narrator told more or less from the perspective of Caroline to somebody from the 18th century, a boy from the 18th century who's writing in the style of that time. Did you find that jarring, or did you find that the presentation was readable, and were there any hiccups with that?
I would say, I mean, as someone who's actually read works from the 17th and 18th, you know, this period, it's very obviously not the English of that period, but modern English made to look like the English of that period to a young adult, which is actually what you need in the
right
in the context. Right. I'm not saying this is a bad thing. I liked it, actually. It did allow me to immerse myself in the story of William Percival Smythe. It was believable. I think that, yeah, a young man probably could have and would have lived like that in that period of time. I just liked it. And of course, all the time I'm thinking that it's Caroline reading the manuscript. It's not me reading it, which is always a good thing when you do not break the reader's immersion into the narrative. This is a very readable book. When I first saw, 200 pages, this is going to take me a long time. But then what happened is I started reading it and I blink and I'm 120 pages in. Wow.
Thank you. That's great to hear. It's very gratifying to hear that.
Right. Right. It's one of these scripts, like it's very readable. It's not, I mean, it is a young adult novel. It's not extremely taxing. You're not forcing yourself to concentrate. It's actually enjoyable and it's good for passing time and for edifying yourself. So that I found very excellent. But I have to say that the Smythe manuscript is probably the best written part of the book, like the absolute
really?
Gold. Yeah, the absolute wow. Gold within the entire novel is the Smythe manuscript. Even though, I mean, it is obviously historically inaccurate, it was very enjoyable.
Thank you.
And so I think that gets into now. I want to ask you, Spencer, about the historicity. Were the historical events of the Shackleford farm and all of that, did that really happen, or are they just representative of the general time period?
The latter. Yeah, I didn't. These are all characters I made up out of whole cloth. These are not. This wasn't based on any kind of historical event specifically. Now, I did read a couple narratives or a couple memoirs of people who had been indentured servants, and so some of the details I would lift and put into the story. So, for example, when their ship grounds on shore and the crew and the captain bail and leave the servants in the ship to die, but then the tide goes out and they don't die, so they have to go back and get them. That really happened with one of the memoirists that I've read. So, you know, there are things that did occur that I just would cobble together to form a story. There are other examples too. I'd have to go through my books, but yeah, not everything did I invent. However, putting them all together, you can't say that this happened as it was presented, but little tidbits here and there certainly did happen. So when Shackelford was accused of murdering a slave before Smythe arrived, you know, that the way it was described, that really did happen. So there's the FT tattooed on the forehead of the fugitive trader. You know, that's a practice that actually did happen back then. I got that from Abbott Emerson Smith in his Colonists in Bondage book that was published, I think, in the mid last century. So yeah, I just basically cobbled it all together from various sources. And there are aspects of it that I did invent, you know, like with the pickpocketing and the minstreling. I mean, that was all my invention. There were certain aspects that I put in my own as well.
Right. Well, you know, it's not out of the out of consideration that a young man would have known how to pick pockets in that period. Pickpocketing, it's a long, not exactly noble tradition, but it is one of the traditions of the English people. You know, right. Theft, piracy.
I'm sure it's everywhere. Not anywhere fraud. Where you have pockets, you're going to have people picking them, I guess.
Money laundering, right. Wonderful English traditions. Just kidding, just a little friendly banter between us Europeans. I really enjoyed it. I love depictions of colonial Virginia. I think it's one of those places where try to get a sense of what the past is like. In many ways, Americans romanticize their past, but I think Uncle Zach's attitude is right. There are no villains and heroes in history. There's no good guys and bad guys. We all share a lot of blame. There is this attitude, of course. There is a way in which, and something that Jim Goat has pointed out, that essentially nowhere in the history of the world do you see as much contempt as the English ruling class had for the English working class. And you see this in the treatment of indentured servants, of the white slaves snatched up from all over the British Isles, sometimes, you know, brought over to Virginia to work as essentially slaves for the enrichment of this gentry that later, now white Southerners who are, for their part, mostly descended from indentured servants, romanticize. That's maybe something we need to look at, you know, a little bit more critically of our history as white people, not what we did to, black people or non-whites, all the way we impressed them, but all of the ways in which we hurt each other in the past and how this made us vulnerable and weak to outside predations. That's maybe something to think about. And this is why I like thinking about colonial Virginia, because it is such a complex place, full of both greatness, but also great shames and pain.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you're absolutely correct. There, I touch upon this in my review of Michael Hoffman's They Were White and They Were Slaves. And I was quite explicit about it. I'm like, you really can't blame the Jews on this one. This is all us. You know, the way that they treated the English working class was really horrible. And you can also, somebody mentioned, I think in the comments, about the Harrowing of the North, I think it's called, or Harrying of the North. You know about that? These were, okay. So that was also pretty awful as well. So we need to,
For the benefit of the audience, would you mind repeating the story?
What I know about it is that after, the Normans won at Hastings in 1066, they pretty much conquered England. However, there were quite a few people to the north that didn't accept, was it Richard the Lionhearted or whoever the king was at the time, they didn't accept his authority. And so there was a campaign of violence against them to suppress them. And over, I'm not really sure how many, how long, how many years, but hundreds of thousands of people were killed. And I think it's called the Harrowing or the Harrying of the North. And it's just, it's a brutal chapter in our history that, you know, you don't really hear about much. And so that this sort of thing has to be, we have to look at it with clear eyes. And that's something that Derek and Brock talk about towards the end of the book, where they say, yeah, we were victims, and it was our own fault as well. I mean, we did it to ourselves, but we can't let that change the fact that we were also victims of others as well. And that we also, you know, everybody is a victim and a victimizer at some point in history. There's no point in, you know, singling out one group of people for shame and not anybody else. So, I mean, that's something that we always have to keep in mind.
Indeed. That's really valuable. That's a really valuable insight, right? We should not feel this crippling shame. We should not think we are not the villains of history as white people. And that's actually a very good soundbite. I need to write that down. We are not the villains of history, right?
Well, be careful, because Richard Nixon was known for saying, "I am not a crook," and that didn't exactly help him to posterity. So we got to be careful.
Well, you know, as it turns out, he really wasn't a crook. Well, we can go down that rabbit hole sometime else. I mean, it could be very interesting. But yeah, okay. So
I have a question for you guys, if unless you have more you want to ask, because I wanted to get one question in before the time is up.
Go ahead. I don't know. DZ, you got any questions for Spencer?
Yeah, I do. But he can ask his first since it's on
we,
his
we
mind.
Have time. We have 25 okay. minutes more, I think. Yes.
Well, I just wanted to know what you guys thought of the artwork.
I don't know. They looked a little bit like the Scooby-Doo characters to me.
That's actually the exact vibe I got. Same thing.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, you know, it's like Rose is obviously Velma and Caroline is Daphne. Now, with the boys, it's a little hard because yeah. Brock is not exactly Fred, and Derek is not exactly Shaggy. And of course, there is no Scooby. But yeah, I would definitely say Caroline is Daphne and Rose is Velma. They look like the Scooby-Doo characters. And that's a good thing, I guess.
This is the first I've heard of this. I hadn't even thought of it. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Let me just, I mean, of course our friends can see it from the thumbnail, but I'm going to bring it up on screen because the resemblance is pretty good. And I think you can see it here. Yeah. It's not one-to-one, but you can definitely see some of the archetypes. This is from the cover page. Of course, I like the artwork. I like the attention to detail. If I'm being honest, like the difference between Uncle Zach's business card, where he's portrayed as he was maybe 20 years ago, and as he is portrayed in the artwork, as he's got the same hair and beard style, he's got the same clothes, but he's very obviously 20 years older.
Right, and
that's
exactly.
A nice touch as someone who has been, bedeviled by this predicament we call aging lately. I can certainly relate, and I like this. You know, you can see attention was given to detail, to the way these guys look, they dress, their physiognomy. Brock's even got that, you know, tilt in the neck, and that little unfocused stare that mildly autistic people tend to have, like the weird body language. I like that. So yeah, I do like the artwork. I find it endearing, to be honest.
Thank you. We also tried to have a different style for the historical chapters.
Right. I noticed. Well, no, not. I don't think I noticed it. Now that you pointed out, I think about it. Yeah, it's good. But it is. They look a little goofy. I mean, after all, they are fictional characters. They got a right to be goofy. But I think it makes them more relatable that way. The contemporary characters, Derek, right. Rose, Brock, and Caroline.
Right.
right? So yeah, they look like Scooby-Doo, but in a positive sense, because, you know, Scooby-Doo is a beloved cartoon.
Yes.
People, and they're going to make it into this whole non-white thing, right? They're going to ruin Scooby-Doo now. Shaggy's going to be black.
Yeah, Velma don't even go there.
Yeah, Velma is a horrible Mexican lesbian. What's her name? Daphne is going to be Asian. Fred is white, but he's going to be a cuck.
Yeah,
and I guess they're going to make Scooby a pit bull or something. Or so it is tragic, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay. That was my question.
DZ, you had a question.
Yeah, sure. I guess you could maybe call this pushback in a kind of way, though. Like, not really. But I'm curious. Hopefully, my question/comment isn't as difficult for you this time, Mr. Quinn, for your sanity. So, this is sort of a young adult realistic fiction, you could say. Around that kind of area, but and perhaps I'm biased due to being the youngest person here. But I do think this book could appeal. I'm not saying it's the target audience, but I do think this book could appeal to adults. And a few examples that like I'll kind of give is like Dazed and Confused, for instance. I know that's very I know that's like a movie that very much towers to like 1970s high school, for instance. And I'll bring up another one, and I'm going to get called a queer for this, but I don't care. Like Mean Girls as well. It's like another movie where it's like the obvious point about it is that like it's high school. So like I do think like with the characters, the guy that's like the obvious jock, the guy the girl that's like the obvious you know the pretty one, the popular one, the nerd, the kind of punkish metalhead and whatnot. I do think that this book could be relatable for older audiences as well. I think you very briefly acknowledged this, but I'm just curious if, I guess I would say I do think adults could read this as well and get something out of it.
Well, absolutely. I mean, by young adult fiction, I never intended it to be only for young adults. I wanted it to be for pretty much anybody seventh grade and up. And I had enough in there that adults would find very interesting as well. And not necessarily exclusive of what kids would find interesting. So they can both find the same stuff interesting, maybe for different reasons or personal reasons. But yes, I definitely wanted to appeal to adults as well. But this is the first time that I've written a novel where I'm also opening the door for younger readers. And that was actually my primary goal is to attract younger readers, but I wanted the door open for adults definitely.
Yeah, I guess it's, and this is another point, and this is one of the reasons why I really enjoyed reading this book, because, you know, we can look at, for instance, to like bring up a current event, there was just this case where like apparently like five black police officers or something, I guess we're like arresting this other black guy and he like died, and yet the media is still going to come out and blame white people. The like take on that is like obvious, but this book, you know, getting race realism, getting white identity, getting it from like a more artistic angle with something with like in the realm of fiction and
right
and the pictures and whatnot. That is really valuable, I think, to the movement.
I agree. I wanted the sense of discovery to be fun, to be exciting, gripping. I wanted younger readers especially, to have a wide range of archetypes that they can address, or that they can latch onto in terms of identity. I mean, so there are some books that are preaching to the choir, where, you know, if you already are in the movement or whatever, or how you describe it, then yeah, you'll understand what's going on. But it's not really going the extra mile to attract new readers very much. Whereas I really tried to do that. And it was with the art as well. I always loved artwork in the paperbacks that I read as a kid, the classic novels like Captain's Courageous or what have you. And I just loved it. And so I wanted to impart that to the reader. I wanted them to really know that there's something special here, that we put a lot of love into it. A lot of work, because we could have published it 8 months ago. The text was ready. We could have done it, but we were like, no, let's make this better. Let's include all these sketches and really put some effort into it. And I wanted the people to be welcomed into this sort of dissidence, and to realize that there's not just truth, but there's also fun, and there's also many kinds of people involved. So that's what I was attempting to do. I hope I succeeded. We'll know, I guess, soon enough if I succeeded.
Well, you've succeeded in impressing me, and I would say writing a very impressive novel, which is readable, it's informative, and I'm going to say it for the millionth time, has some very strong, very vivid characters. It's something, you notice in great literature that the characters feel real because people like them in your life. Nobody's trying to sell you. This is, for example, what I hated about reading in Ayn Rand.
Oh,
there are no people like that. People like that don't exist.
I'm not a big fan of hers. I know Greg Johnson loves Atlas Shrugged. I've only read The Fountainhead, and that's for a talk for another day. But I'm not a big fan of her approach, and I think you hit the nail on the head with that.
Yeah. Okay. So one final thing I would like to discuss is, in the chapter where Caroline is taking the bus home, where she's essentially staring at her phone and looking at her social life online disappear, right? The social media aspect of it. I found that very interesting because I think it imparts, like we said, the didactic function of young adult fiction. It imparts an important lesson onto the intended audience, which is young people, is that social media is not life. You can have hundreds of thousands of friends on Facebook, but they're not really your friends, are they? But if you have three close friends, well, actually, you can fill your day with some pretty interesting activities, right? Because you have three close friends, people you can just call and say, hey, want to hang out? And they do hang out. You don't have to make special plans. It is what people do. And of course, when we get to the chapters with Uncle Zach, you can see another way in which you can use the internet, because like we said, Uncle Zach, he's a lettered man. He's obviously very highly educated, and he's part of this informal group of intellectuals, of scholars, who are reconstructing history, hidden history. He's doing it all over the internet, right? He's connected with groups over the internet. So he's using technology for good. Whereas the way in which the children, right, the high school kids, they use the internet, and especially the way Medina and all these other Black people use the internet. And of course, the internet is a massive factor in the novel, right? Caroline's interaction with Medina and Jennifer and Priya, where she refuses to condemn Derek, is what is the beginning of her quote-unquote downfall into racism, because it's recorded and it's posted online and it goes viral. And then you have towards the end, there's more videos that go viral, right? We're not going to do spoilers. But I wanted to ask you about, what were you thinking? What were you thinking of the lessons you were trying to impart and the mood you were trying to generate with the presence of technology in the novel? Because it has been said before, like, that we as authors struggle with the appearance of the internet and cell phones, because Seinfeld is made obsolete by the cell phone, and that just punches a huge hole in narrative structure.
Right.
Well, but I like the way this was integrated. Right. What were you thinking there?
Well, Medina weaponizes the internet. And it's clearly, I mean, Caroline realizes that she's been attacked, and this is not a trivial attack. This was a vicious attack, and it all came through the internet. That is her downfall, and it is very, very swift. 30, 40 years ago, they would be impossible to make it that dramatic because you didn't have the internet. And so therefore the word would get out a lot more slowly and it would be word of mouth. And it's like a big game of telephone. Whereas with the internet, you don't really have that. It's all very immediate. It's all direct and nobody cares. So, I saw this video once of this white girl who was drunk. And like a college girl, and she clearly is an alcoholic or going to be, because she becomes a completely different person when she's drunk, and she's calling people the N-word and stuff and just being really obnoxious. You can't defend her. These other college students were just recording her, and one black girl who was recording her said, your life is over, baby. You're done. And there's just no mercy. There's no sense of, the cruelty that it takes to just destroy this person because, clearly they're an alcoholic. They have a problem and you're just like, well, I'm going to make things worse for you now. So there's that element. It's very much the Wild West. Also, you'll notice that I don't say Facebook or Twitter. None of these platforms are mentioned. It's only social media. I kind of wanted to stay away from specifics because, first of all, in 30 years, we don't know if Facebook is still around. I mean, who knows? But I also didn't want to give them any props or anything, any kind of oxygen. I just wanted to just call it social media. And so that will pretty much, it makes things a tad clunkier because there are times when I wish I could just say Twitter because it would flow off the tongue better. But, I can't say Twitter. So I stayed away from that. But you're right about Uncle Zach with the internet. You're absolutely correct. I mean, it is a great tool for sharing knowledge and whatnot. So yeah, you make an excellent point about that.
Right. I mean, because you got a lot of criticism from, some nationalists, some right wingers about the internet, this and that online. You're living in the metaverse. You're not having an authentic experience. I'm like, well, I'm having probably the most authentic experience in my life over the internet because, I cannot have an academic career because of my political views and because of my winning personality, obviously, but mainly my political views. It's a long story, but the reason why I can do the thing I do, and enjoy it, which I actually enjoy making these shows, I enjoy writing for Countercurrents, I enjoy my correspondence with this worldwide nationalist network, it's because of the internet. It was not possible before the internet. You try trolling someone through snail mail. I tried once. Maybe we should do it like for the joke. Send someone a postcard with a funny meme. But that's something you do with close friends. I don't think you can do it at the scale that we do. So I see the internet as a tool. I do not see it as something evil, right? I don't think that just because something is happening online that makes it inauthentic. And maybe I should write more deeply about this, but I like that little detail that you put in there that, yeah, there's these people using social media specifically for evil, for, using it as a weapon, using it to torture people, to ruin their lives. But there's also good ways. And of course, our characters towards the end, they start using the internet for good, actually. I want to hear from Daily Zoomer on this. Because apparently his generation grew up online. They were born on the internet. They didn't see the outside until they were already men, unlike us millennials who merely adopted the internet.
I guess just before my experience, just pointing out the obvious, and I know he gets worse and worse by the day, but Donald Trump would have not become president had it not been for Twitter, obviously. And that's obvious, right? Right in your face. But yeah, I would say that the metasphere is really, really,
real to people now. I mean, people don't really know their neighbors in many cases here in America. They're spending a lot more time on Facebook at this point and, you know, other social media. So no, I would completely concur. Yes.
Spencer, you were going to say something.
No, I was not. I mean, yeah, I mean, everything you're saying is, I agree with that. I mean, this social media can just destroy your, if you go into it too much, you know, it can destroy your interpersonal relations and, you know, you can lose more friends than you gain. That's also possible. But you know, if you abuse anything, it's going to be bad. And there are uses of internet and social media that are quite good. So, you know, if you're a grandmother and you want to get pictures of your grandkids when they go on trips or whatever, I mean, of course you're going to be on Facebook. So you're going to gobble up all these great things that your children and grandchildren are doing. I mean, there is a very useful aspect of it that has nothing to do with what we're talking about. And that's, I think, the main reason why you have, one of the reasons why it's stayed around so long is because, you know, people want to share photographs of their dinner. They want to share photographs of themselves, you know, when they go to Mount Rushmore. And it's so much easier to do that than to send a 20 megabyte email to 7 people. You just put it on your Facebook page and then everybody gets to see it. And so there's a lot of excellent stuff there. It's just that once you start using it as a medium for serious intellectual debate and that kind of thing, that's where, you know, it could get very difficult and could be very problematic. So, yeah, I mean, there's good and bad with anything, and you can abuse anything and make it really bad. So we got to be careful before we, you know, make a blanket condemnation of the internet or social media, because it does have its uses. But yeah, as far as the novel is concerned, it is a double-edged sword for sure. And Caroline gets cut pretty bad.
Well, I guess, we can have our opinions of it, but like I said, it's a detail I appreciate. We are nearing towards the end of our allotted time, so I would like to hear closing words. Let's hear from Daily Zoomer first, as a reader of the text and part of the intended audience. What would you be your closing remarks about today's show and The No College Club by Spencer J. Quinn?
Yeah, so I really enjoyed the book. I thought it was insightful. I thought it was fun, and I thought it was funny too. I thought it had very good humor in there as well. I would reverberate what I said earlier in the sense that, you know, we see, you know, like, oh, what's the take on the professor at the university saying all I want for Christmas is like white genocide or something? Like the take on that is obvious. Getting a sort of artistic take, reading, you know, good fiction, a story with like made up characters that has so much value for you to get that kind of different sort of take, a different angle, a different way to take in what's happening around you. So I would say this is definitely worth the read and definitely worth to buy. It's a closing statement.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
I definitely agree with that. I know I laughed out loud at several parts, especially when Derek was mogging Dr. Nogimbe in the initial chapters. Spencer, do you have any closing remarks about today's show? And do you actually have a better understanding of your own work after having engaged in this kind of reviewing?
Well, I never thought about Scooby-Doo before in this regard. So thank you, gentlemen, for that, for sure. No, definitely. Anytime that I see people discussing my work and thinking about things that I hadn't thought of or interpreting things in ways that I hadn't considered, it's always very enlightening. And I appreciate very much all the comments, the critical ones as well. It's just a wealth of information, and I appreciate it. All I have to say in closing is that I'm hoping to make the No College Club a series, and I've already started part two. All I can say about it is that it the main character is going to be a boy this time. But the formula, it will follow a formula of sorts, really, where you have, a high school student or students who run afoul of political correctness, whether it's accidental, whether it's deliberate, and they get in really big trouble for it really fast. Because, you know, after the Covington kid episode a few years ago, they don't care how young you are. They don't care if you're a child. It's like that line in The Incredibles. You know, they don't care that you're a child. They're just going to go after you. These people, there's no no mercy in them. And so, you know, I want to have a routine where, or a formula where you have these kids who get in trouble and the No College Club comes in to help. And then ultimately it will be about the protagonists overcoming what they need to overcome to become men and women.
Indeed. And here's a chance for maybe to set the story on the West Coast and provide maybe a local experience over there with the mestizo threat. Which, like I said, you know, it's the mestizos are glaring by their omission from the text, even though for most Americans they are the primary demographic threat. But in general, like I said, this is an enjoyable book, very strong, very vivid characters, excellent concept, you know, a story of overcoming political correctness and stifling conformity of modern America. It's one of the good ones, you know. It's also very readable and enjoyable. And thank you, Mr. Quinn, for writing this excellent work. And I guess that's been the writer's block. I'm your friend and host, Nicholas R. Gilvey, and our guests tonight were Spencer J. Quinn and Daily Zoomer. We were discussing Spencer J. Quinn's The No College Club, a white nationalist young adult novel, a story about four kids run afoul of political correctness and are accused of racism. But they get better in the end. The end is actually so happy, I think I have diabetes now. I want to thank everyone from the future who donated. I want to thank everyone, again, from the future who participated in the chat and who watched the show, who's listening to the replay. I want to thank Spencer and Daily Zoomer for appearing on the show. Thank you, guys. Thank you for a very enjoyable 2 hours. And finally, I want to thank our courageous and indomitable moderators, Gadius Maximus, Bartleby, and Reed Johnson, who are in the future moderating the chat, keeping it safe, and keeping everyone abreast of all of the relevant information. And with that, I guess, bye-bye, people.
Thank you very much. It was great having me.